How many of you have read the Bible before? How many of you cover to cover? How many of you kind of the highlights? I think in even Christian churches, we'd have the same ratio of highlights to cover to cover, so don't feel bad. When you read the Bible, there are many moments that Nancy Bowen, former district executive here, would say would be classified as WTF moments. Well, that's fascinating. It's this time of year that I start to think about the nativity story of all of the moments that we might say, well, that's fascinating about each of the parts. It seems each time I encounter the story in the Christian Bible of the Nativity, I am pulled in by a different set of the cast. Sometimes it's the parents making a perilous journey back home at the orders of a government seeking refuge. Sometimes it's the Magi, people seeking to go into a country not their own, to follow a great calling. But this year, I've been most present to the work of the shepherds. You remember them, right? The ordinary shepherds. There they were, just minding their own business, tending to their flocks, making sure the wolves didn't make off with their livelihood. There they were, when an angel of the Lord appears. Now, it's very hard to find any reference in the Bible to which an angel arriving is met with anything but fear. It's true. Most of us think of angels in this, like, cherubim, nice, like, harps. But everyone in the Bible, when they meet an angel, they are terrified. Not only are they terrified, you can tell this, because what's the first thing an angel usually says to a mortal upon greeting? Don't be afraid. That's your opening line. We know what's up. And so despite this terror of this angelic host breaking into their ordinary lives, much like they might break into yours, today or yesterday, when you were just going about your business, doing your ordinary tasks, despite this interruption and this terror, the shepherd's response was one of openness. Openness to hear the story of the angels, openness to follow a star off in the distance, openness to go and meet a crying baby. Thank you, Trisha. I mean, if an angel of the Lord appeared to you today and told you to drop everything you were doing and set out in search of some newborn, I'm imagining your response may be something like, yeah, right. Did I accidentally take an edible? Or maybe you'd want to believe in such a divine message of a prophecy foretold, but somehow couldn't allow yourself to fully. You might ascribe to a more Jeffersonian view of the nativity story. For Thomas Jefferson actually composed his own Bible. Have you heard of this? The Jefferson Bible. What he did was he took the Gospels of Jesus and he cut out all of the parts that he thought a modern mind would find irrational, fantastical, mystical, miraculous. And so the story of the birth of Jesus is much different. It goes something like this. Caesar Augustus sent out a decree that all the world should be taxed. Mary and Joseph went home and had a baby. Then Jesus was 12. The whole story of the Nativity is but a page and a half. And there's something beautiful in this retelling. There's something beautiful because it lifts up the ordinariness of Jesus. That any birth, not heralded by angels, visited upon by kings, could be the birth that would upset the status quo, that would give voice to the voiceless, that would bring compassion to the suffering and let the captives go free. There is a beauty in the ordinariness of this story. But there's also a danger. And the danger is that when we read that story, it almost seems inevitable. Inevitable that there is a decree. Inevitable that they would follow it. Inevitable that they would give birth to Jesus. Inevitable that he would have an impact upon his followers and in our time. That it was, of course, this would happen. But it didn't need to, right? And so at this time of year, I find myself living in between these stories. In between the story of the ordinariness of Jesus's birth and the fantastical significance that one invites me into a sense of possibility and hope, and the other grounds me in this life, not something else. It is living in between these two poles that I call this the nativity conspiracy, that something utterly ordinary can happen that will change everything. And that we're not going to know until it happens. Because when you think about your life, and you think about the life of our human species, there's in fact never been something extraordinary that emerged from anything other than the ordinary. Nothing in your life, nothing in our collective lives has ever emerged from anything but the commonness of the everyday. It is the commonness of the everyday in which, as Nelson Mandela says, it seems impossible until it's done. That there is something possible. And yet we trick ourselves time and time again. We trick ourselves sometimes even with this nativity story. We trick ourselves to think that it's only special people in a special time, in special circumstances, with special training. That it's only this specialness that would give rise to the extraordinary. That that is reserved for someone else. We disenfranchise ourselves and each other of something emerging from our lives, from this moment and our time, that would break all of our perceptions. That would turn the world upside down. And so it is at this time, as we encounter these stories and this conspiracy, that I invite us into a spiritual practice of openness. A spiritual practice that allows us to respond to angelic messengers with both terror and a reluctant yes. A yes to life and to its possibilities of something greater. And this spiritual practice of openness has three components, three practices that build upon each other that allow ourselves to truly be open. We first have to observe. We have to root ourselves in the fullness of what is, so that the second step can happen. Once we're fully rooted in the fullness of what is, the second step is for us to ponder. To let our minds and souls and bodies open to imagine how there could be more love, more justice, more truth, more caring, more compassion unlocked and evoked in this moment. To ponder the possibilities of what could be born beyond our expectations, judgments, or preconceptions. We observe, we ponder, and then the final step of this openness is not just something we can do inside, but something we must do outside, which is to conspire. To conspire to become co-conspirators, midwives of possibility to this love or tenderness or care being born in the world. So step one. observe. I had a very spiritual experience in seminary once with a raisin. The great UU theologian Tendaka had gathered seminarians from across the country, and she gave each of us a raisin, and she told us we were going to have a transcendent experience. That's what seminary is about. She told us to take the raisin, this dried grape, put it in our mouths, and begin to chew. So we did. It was unremarkable at first, much like chewing a raisin is. But then she invited each of us, to experience ourselves experiencing chewing the raisin, which takes a little bit to get your mind around. But what she's inviting us to do is to kind of step outside ourselves and experience our experience of our experience, right? To kind of get a sense of what's going on, to not just be in it, but to watch ourselves be in it. Have you had an experience like this? But there's kind of a grandness that can open, a sense of possibility or a greaterness, like the lens of our lives opens and you sense yourself as part of something, even when all you're doing is mashing up a raisin. I've found this practice of openness very useful when I attend modern dance shows. My husband has been modern dancing for most of his life. How many of you have seen modern dance before? I mean, it's a trip, right? You never quite know what to expect. It took me years to be able to distinguish between, like, unskillful modern dance and skillful modern dance. I would kind of leave a performance and say, "So was that good?" Usually the response is, "That's not the point." I go, okay, but like, was it good? Well, what I would do when I found myself in some of those performances that weren't very good, which I was able to tell, is that I kind of put on my Margaret Mead anthropologist hat, and I just sat there and said, "Well, isn't this fascinating? Isn't it fascinating that humans would come together to watch each other move? Isn't it fascinating that we would develop a whole style, a whole story contained without words? Isn't it fascinating that we would all gather to watch something that we may not even enjoy or understand? Isn't it fascinating?" Stepping outside to sense that grandness of the story. That there may be more in that moment if only we allowed ourselves to experience it. To reflect what is there already, but our preconceptions sometimes block out. To expand that lens wider and wider, relinquishing control, relinquishing preconception, letting go of our need to comport the situation or other people into tiny or predictable boxes, to be open to wonder and wildness and unknowability. To reflect and refract what is, to be open. So if openness is our first step, then we move into the second step, which is to ponder. In the step of pondering, we allow ourselves not simply to observe what is, but to ponder what could be. To not see only what the situation would prescribe as possible, but to ponder what could be, how more love, more justice, more joy could be born in this moment. And this is terribly difficult at the best of times. It's terribly difficult to have seen a baby in a manger, born of poor parents in the first century in Palestine, and have the capacity to see a 32-year-old revolutionary challenging the status quo, speaking for the downtrodden, a person whose life would come to its end tragically. It is difficult to ponder possibility. it's difficult not only to start to shrug off all of the stories that we tell ourselves about what is possible. It's also difficult to stay in that pondering because it opens us up. It opens us up against our better reactions. Because we like quick answers. We like knowing. We like understanding. But pondering asks us to stay those impulses, to resist the quick answer, to stay in possibility and in knowing. And the deeper we go, the more uncertain it gets. And we don't like uncertainty in our culture. And in fact, neurologically, we don't like uncertainty. Neurologists say we are wired against it. And in fact, when we encounter an uncertain situation, our brain's response is to begin generating plausible answers, to close the gap of uncertainty. Uncertainty, unknowing, ambiguity, it distresses us. It opens up cracks and gaps and faults and fjords in us. Questions arise like, where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? Why did this happen? Is there a way out? Am I going to be okay? Can this be resolved? What was that about? How did that happen? Who's responsible? What's that person's deal? Am I wrong? Did I hurt them? What's going on? Right? It evokes a deep yearning for what social psychologist Ari Kruglensky defines as cognitive closure. Staying in this openness evokes this deep desire, this deep yearning in us for cognitive closure, which is that the longer we dwell in possibility, even though it unlocks more and more possibilities, it increases our pain of not knowing what's going to happen. The more we stay in grief and questioning and wondering, the more we stay in paralysis before making a decision, the more that gap is opened, the more we desire to close it. And while the need for closure varies from person to person, for a large extent, our situations can determine how much, how able we are to live in that uncertainty. The more in flux our environment, the more indeterminate our lives, the more questions that are up in the air, the more status quos that have already been turned upside down, the less likely we are to want to stay in uncertainty, right? The more things that have changed, the bigger the news, the more personal it is, the more we want to close it down. To not see possibilities, but see what is going to happen. Our need for cognitive closure usually consists of two major stages, seizing and freezing. The first step when we feel this distress, when we're trying to figure out what's going on in a situation and we want an answer quickly, is we reach out and seize whatever information we can without necessarily taking the time to verify it, especially when we're stressed, especially when our country is stressed. Especially when we have a pain inside that we need a response to, we reach out for answers that may not be verified. And once we have seized those answers, because we are driven for permanence, we are driven not to want to feel this pain of uncertainty again, we freeze. We keep our response for as long as possible, freezing our knowledge, not seeking out knowledge that would contradict it, not seeking out other possibilities, because we want to safeguard this closure. We seize and freeze. But this closing down, this responding to our fear quickly, reactively, reflexively, reactionarily, is not an antidote to life. It is, in fact, us pushing life away. For the antidote to fear is not what closes us down from life and ambiguity, but what opens us up to life's complexity and possibility. So for each other and ourselves, we need to develop a collective capacity to stay in ambiguity and uncertainty so that the greatest possibility might be realized together, rather than the quick and concrete answers of the status quo being pulled in. Observe, ponder. The final step is conspire. As is now apparently a trope in my sermons, I'm going to use a European political example to illustrate this point. So if you'll remember the 2014 Ukrainian election. So in 2004, Ukraine had an election in which the incumbent, Viktor Yanukovych, clearly lost the election. International observers said that his government and the media rigged the ballot. And hundreds of thousands of people across Ukraine poured into the streets to protest their votes, their lives being taken away from them. But none of that, none of those protests were seen on Ukrainian TV. The state TV network didn't show any of the protests. The other major TV networks were intimidated, even though they were privately held, intimidated that if they showed the protest, if they went against the government, they would be taken over, their livelihoods destroyed, their privilege denied. So even though it was clear there was a problem, millions of Ukrainians, if they didn't notice what was going on in the street or there weren't protests in the area, would not have known what was going on. Would become the Orange Revolution. And in that moment, in that stalemate between government and military backed by Russia and the people rising up for their voice, enters Natalia Dmytruk. Natalia Dmytruk was a sign language interpreter for Ukraine's state television channel. She was that tiny little box in the corner of the major news station, in which she would translate the words of the anchors so that those who could not hear could understand. And even though only a fraction of the population could understand what she was saying, for a brief moment, one broadcast, she refused to translate the lies coming out of the mouth of the news anchor, refused to say that Viktor Yanukovych was elected fairly, and said through her signs, "Everything you have heard so far on the news was a total lie." The other candidate, both named Viktor because it's confusing, Viktor Yushchenko is our true president. Goodbye. You will probably never see me here again. Just imagine, you're going about your ordinary day and you risk everything for a fraction of the population to maybe see truth. She walks out of the studio greeted with shock and hugs, not knowing what would happen. The news of this spread throughout the news station. And those who were on the fence, those who were on the fence of joining a general strike until the truth was told, got off the fence because of her courage. Children's television producers, administrative staff, all came to demand that the owner of the station tell the truth. And in a meeting where they all gathered, they forced the hand of the network president, in which he told them, "Yes, you can tell the truth." She observed the fullness of what was going on, the lies, but also the movement. She pondered what possibilities could be evoked. How could more justice, how could more love be allowed to break forth in this moment? And she conspired to be a small part of a movement of more love without any conception that it would work or that she would be rewarded in any way. She was open, maybe not hopeful, but open. And this is why openness is a difficult spiritual practice, because it is not one that promises quick answers or easy results. But if together we are able to suspend disbelief, to nourish a positive yet unstructured commitment to life, even in its messiness, that if we are to be open to what could be without needing answers, maybe the weight of our expectations or even the weight of hope that can seem too much will be let go for simply the sight of a tiny razor thin crack in the wall of despair to open up. A thin crack of potential. The wonder that the smallest thing might go on to the greatest impact. Which brings us back to those shepherds. Those shepherds in their fields on their ordinary day, not knowing that a tiny baby would go on to change the face of human history. We're all part of this nativity conspiracy, all part of this work that something utterly ordinary can happen and change everything if only we are open to it, if only we allow ourselves to be open. Opening ourselves to the nativity of each moment, of each breath, of each of us. In many ways, our own Noel. Amen.